Just before Vespers, the three sergeants from Echo reassemble together in a secure conference room, awaiting the arrival of Preceptor Willem Johansson, the man who had taken over after Michaels had perished in the commandery assaults 3 weeks before. A moment or two after Duncan's appearance, the Preceptor arrived. With him was a short, barrel-chested man in standard-issue battle dress uniform, or BDU, with a captain's insignia on the shoulders. They settled into seats opposite the members of Echo, and the Preceptor didn't waste any time in getting down to business.
"We've got a dangerous situation brewing that needs to be dealt with quickly and decisively. Bravo and Delta are off cleaning up that mess in Argentina. Alpha is at half strength, and Charlie is still en route from Moscow. That leaves you. I know your team leader is currently unavailable, but Echo is all I've got."
Johansson was tall and thin, with long arms that moved restlessly about whenever he spoke, reminding Duncan of a praying mantis. The man's regal attitude and obvious sense of self-importance reinforced the comparison, causing Duncan to take an instant dislike to him. The transfer to Echo had been difficult, there was no question of that. But in the long run, he suspected that working for a man like Johansson would be a kind of slow torture all its own, and he was glad he was no longer in the charge of the Preceptor's security detail. Riley ignored the thinly veiled distaste in the Preceptor's tone when referring to Commander Williams, and simply nodded his acceptance of the situation. The Preceptor indicated the man seated beside him.
"Captain Mason here is with the unit on the ground. He will conduct the briefing and answer any questions you have, Captain Mason."
Mason was the physical opposite of Johansson, and he projected an air of experience that commanded authority.
"Thank you, sir."
Mason stepped away from the table and over to the podium. Removing a small remote from his pocket, he used it to trigger the ceiling projector. A photograph of a smiling man dressed in the black clothes of a Catholic priest appeared on the screen. He was in his late 40s or early 50s, with a full head of dark hair and the tanned complexion of a man who spent a lot of time outdoors.
"This is Father Juan Vargas, a Jesuit archaeologist. He has spent his entire life sifting the dirt of the Holy Land through his hands, looking for physical evidence of the life of Christ. Many considered him one of the finest expedition leaders of our time, and his work has uncovered priceless artifacts supporting biblical scholarship. From discovering the home of Pontius Pilate just outside of Jerusalem, to excavating the secret tunnels discovered beneath the fortress of Masada, Vargas has been at the forefront of some of the most important archaeological discoveries of the last four decades. And he's also had his share of failures, however. Entire expeditions that were based on nothing more than rumors, wild goose chases that bled the coffers of many a foundation dry, with nothing to show for it in the end but handfuls of dust. From Noah's Ark to the Ark of the Covenant, Vargas has chased them all. Now, a little over 3 years ago, Vargas abruptly disappeared after a failed dig on the shore of the Dead Sea. Now, some say he deliberately went into hiding, unwilling or unable to face the wrath of his creditors. Others believe that his health was failing and that the constant strain of the expeditionary life was finally too much for him. Whatever the reason, he disappeared. And no one has seen nor heard from him since. Until 9 days ago, that is."
The image on the screen changed. The new photo showed a man in a hospital bed. Though his face was badly sunburned and he had several days' overgrowth of beard, it was clearly Father Vargas.
"Vargas was found wandering in the desert outside of Santa Limas, New Mexico, last Wednesday. From his condition, it was clear he'd been exposed to the elements for several days. He was badly sunburned and dangerously dehydrated. Now, there's no hospital in Santa Limas, so the locals brought him to the parish priest. When the priest discovered the injured man was a fellow member of the clergy, he contacted his bishop. The bishop had actually met Vargas at a seminar several weeks before. Recognizing him, he arranged to have him transferred to St. Margaret's, a private Catholic hospital in Albuquerque. Now, once he was stabilized, we..."
The door to the conference room opened, and Mason's expression of surprise was clear to those seated at the table. As one, they turned to see the source of the disruption. Knight Commander Cade Williams stood framed in the doorway. Duncan and the others stared in disbelief. 2 hours ago, Cade was lying immobile in a hospital bed, so weak he needed an intravenous line to feed him and an oxygen line to help him breathe. His physician had predicted it would be a month, maybe more, before Cade had recovered enough to move about on his own, never mind return to active duty. Yet here he stood, seemingly healed. His face showed signs of weariness and there was a dark, haunted look in his eyes, but his flesh no longer looked stretched taut over his bones, and the sickly yellow hue was gone from his skin. He crossed the room and took a seat in the empty chair next to Riley. He nodded to Captain Mason and then addressed the preceptor.
My apologies for being late, sir. I was briefly detained on another matter.
Preceptor Johansson stared at Cade with a horrified expression on his face, as if Cade's very presence proved that all of the dark and dangerous rumors that were whispered about him were true. Several times, Johansson opened his mouth to speak, only to close it again before doing so, unable or unwilling to give voice to what he was thinking. The silence stretched like a living thing. Duncan stared down the length of the table at his commanding officer. Like the others, he was startled by Cade's appearance. He'd wrestled with his conscience long and hard beside the man's hospital bed, but in the end, he'd done nothing more than get down on his knees and pray for the night commander's recovery. While he'd been sorely tempted to lay his hands on him, he'd resisted the urge, believing that his gift should be used only in the direst of circumstances. While Cade's injuries had been bad, he'd certainly passed beyond the life-threatening stage once he'd arrived at the hospital, and so Duncan had refrained from taking any action beyond simple prayer. Thoughts of prayers and powers and destiny itself chased each other through Duncan's mind.
Good to have you with us, Knight Commander. The circumstances being what they were, the Order was called in to investigate. A 3-man team, including myself, was sent out to speak with Father Vargas. When we arrived at St. Margaret's, we found him to be alternating between spells of manic activity and near catatonia. When he was lucid, if you could call it that, he would rant and rave, screaming and crying and mumbling, throwing himself against his restraints, until the hospital staff was forced to sedate him to keep him from hurting himself.
Was anything he said coherent?
Not much. Most of it was gibberish, odd phrases and sounds that seemed to mimic a language, but unlike anything we'd ever heard before. We've since had the tapes analyzed for linguistic continuity and similarity, thinking it might be a dialect we simply weren't familiar with, but came up dry. If it was a language, it's one we've never heard of. We had Vargas transferred to the custody of the church and took him to our medical facility in New York. There, we were able to monitor him 24 hours a day, and every second of it was caught on video. Upon reviewing the tapes, we discovered this.
Mason touched a button on his remote, and a video began to run on the screen behind him. In it, Vargas was flat on his back on an adjustable bed and was secured with restraints. He was tossing his head from side to side, his eyes tightly closed. This went on for a while, and Duncan was about to ask why this was relevant when Vargas stopped moving. Very slowly, he turned his head to face the camera, and his eyes popped open wide.
He's waiting for you. There in the garden, waiting to show you the truth, if you have the courage to face it.
Mason paused the tape at that point, leaving Vargas to stare out of the screen at those assembled.
We've got 4 days of tape. That's the only coherent moment in any of them.
Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
The captain turned to face Riley.
No, not really. He was reportedly raving about the apocalypse and quoting from the Book of Revelation when he was first discovered outside of San Olimus. So some of the doctors think this is more of the same. The garden possibly being a reference to the Garden of Eden, and the he Vargas is referring to being the serpent. Personally, I'm not so sure. But that's simply a gut-level reaction, and I don't have any concrete evidence one way or the other.
If you have Vargas in custody and he's no real threat to anyone, what do you need Echo for?
Captain Mason is getting to that.
Right. Vargas was given a thorough medical exam by our own physicians, and they discovered something the doctors at St. Margaret's had not. A series of numbers were tattooed on the inside of Vargas' lower lip. The tattoo was crude, obviously homemade, and the numbers were backward, as if Vargas had done it himself with the help of a mirror. After further investigation, we determined that the numbers were a set of GPS coordinates. They led us here.
Another click of the remote, and Vargas's wide-eyed grimace was replaced with an aerial shot of a compound somewhere in the desert. Several buildings were surrounded by a wide fenced perimeter, with a single dirt road leading to and from the compound.
It's an old military base, hidden in the canyons about 30 miles north of Santa Limas, abandoned and mothballed since the close of the Korean War. When my people looked into it, they learned that it had been leased to a holding company based out of the Caymans 3 years ago, roughly 6 months after Vargas disappeared from view.
Have your people been on site?
Yes. We set up operations around the perimeter, and then sent in an advance squad to take a look around. None of the team survived.
Can you be a bit more specific, sir?
We sent in a full squad. 8 men. They were tied into the ops net so we could see and hear everything they did in real time. At first, things went just fine. They searched the few remaining structures and were getting ready to come back out when one of the team discovered a hatch in the floor of the base garage. The hatch appeared to lead to another level of structure, this one underground. The squad checked in and I gave the order for them to continue their search. They were preparing to descend into the lower levels when everything came apart. We lost the video feed almost immediately. We still had the audio, however, and we could hear several of the men shouting and firing at something that we suspect came out of the tunnel after them. Within seconds, we'd lost contact with all of them. Another team was gearing up to go in after them when one man made it back out of the compound. Corporal Jackson's left arm was missing, and he had a gaping wound in his chest. The medics got to work immediately, but everyone knew it was a losing battle right from the start. Jackson was nearly hysterical, raving about a gateway to hell and the demons that had come boiling up out of it, but we were unable to get anything of tactical value out of him before he passed. I can't tell you what he saw, but whatever it was, it scared him silly. Hell, he scared us just by talking about it. And it took his life along with the lives of 7 other men. After that, the decision was made to have the second team stand down while we brought in the heavy guns.
That's where Echo comes in. I'm ordering you to accompany Captain Mason back to the site and determine just what killed those men. When you do, you are authorized to deal with it as you see fit. Are you up to this, Commander?
Cade nodded, but said nothing. Duncan wasn't surprised. He couldn't imagine Echo being sent out without its commander, and he knew it would take more than a doctor or two to keep Cade from joining his unit when they were headed into danger. Duncan was still wondering just how the commander had pulled it off when Cade glanced surreptitiously in his direction and winked. As the meeting broke up around him and the rest of the men headed for the door, Duncan found himself frozen in his seat, his thoughts whirling.
Good Lord, he thinks I did it. He thinks I healed him.
But he knew he hadn't. And that brought him back to the issue that had been bothering him ever since Cade had stepped into the room. If he hadn't done it, who had?
2 minutes out, sir.
They'd landed at the airport in Albuquerque 20 minutes ago to find the 3 Blackhawks waiting for them. The locals were used to military types coming in and out of Kirkland Air Base and didn't think anything of the choppers. Cade and the rest of the command squad had taken the lead bird, while Captain Mason and the men of First Squad climbed into the second. Their gear was loaded into the 3rd Blackhawk, and after that, it had been an uneventful flight across the desert and through a maze of canyons to their present position. Cade was stowing away the briefing papers he had been studying when the pilot broke in again.
What the hell is that?
Cade looked up, and for the first time in a long while, was greeted with an unobstructed view. Gone were the twisting channels of the canyons they'd been following. Now a large open valley stretched out before them. An isolated group of buildings could be seen alone in the distance, obviously the old military base mentioned in their briefing. To the east of the base, closest to them, he could see several mobile command centers and other assorted vehicles assembled into a makeshift camp, Mason's staging area for the earlier excursion into the base. But what had caught the pilot's attention was the swirling mass of charcoal-black thunderclouds that hovered low over the facility. Storm clouds that twisted and churned with the urgency of Class 5 river rapids. Green and silver lightning danced through the darkness, with the occasional bolt slashing down from the heavens to strike the fence that surrounded the base in a dazzling display of pyrotechnics. Even stranger was the column of darkness that rose from the midst of it all like a waterspout and seemed to be the source of the turmoil above. Cade had seen storm clouds like this before, but never in this world. The fact that they were here now, on this side of reality, chilled him to the bone. But strangely, despite his apprehension, Cade also felt an odd sense of excitement grow in him at the sight. The clouds were the same as those in his recurring dream about the adversary. While he had long suspected that the setting of those dreams might just be a real place, either somewhere here in the natural world or on the other side of the veil in the beyond, this was the first time he'd had even the faintest glimmering of evidence to support his suspicions. And if the clouds were real, then that fated confrontation with the adversary might turn out to be real as well.
Can you get a reading on those things? That's about moving or staying steady. Get a reading? Man, that thing doesn't even show up on radar. See for yourself.
It was true. Glancing over, Cade could see that the pilot's scope was perfectly clear, as if the thunderclouds didn't exist. If they had been flying by instruments only, they could have flown right into the funnel without any warning whatsoever.
Could you bring us in a little closer?
Yeah, I could, if there was any valid reason for doing so. But you gotta be kidding.
Just do it. That's an order.
Your funeral.
As the pilot moved to comply, Cade got on the radio to the other two helicopters.
Blackbird lead to Blackbird flight.
Go lead.
I'm gonna check out those storm clouds. I want the two of you to hit the deck and start unloading the gear. I'll join you momentarily.
Roger that, lead.
I hear you, lead. On the deck and unloading in three.
Blackbird lead out.
The pilot took them in as close as he dared, letting Cade get a good long look. The helicopter bounced around in the wash from the funnel cloud, but the pilot was good and kept them on station. This close, Cade could see that the funnel was stationary. Like a shaft of light, it emerged from the ground in an open area on the far side of the base and shot straight upward. At a height of about 400 feet, it simply spread outward in a churning mass from its center, the way smoke will when it encounters a ceiling. Ground Zero was obscured from view, so he couldn't tell if the clouds were man-made, though he suspected they were not. He'd never heard of a piece of machinery that could do something like this, and sorcery of this magnitude would have revealed itself in other ways. Whatever it was, he had little doubt that it was intimately connected to whatever Vargas and his unknown colleagues had been doing at the facility, and Cade was determined to get to the bottom of it. One last glance, and then he turned away from the window.
All right, let's get out of here. I've seen enough.
Amen to that.
But they wouldn't get away that easily. As the pilot banked away from the funnel, a freak surge of wind swept over them, literally shoving the aircraft as if brushed aside by the hand of a giant, tipping them over. Cade's right-hand window abruptly became his floor, and he found himself staring down through the glass at the ground far beneath him.
Come on! Come on!
The pilot fought the controls, doing what he could to restore command of the aircraft before they ended up strewn all over the landscape. Just as he seemed to get things under control, a bolt of silver-green lightning lashed out from the cloud above them, striking the helicopter somewhere behind the crew compartment. Sparks flew from the controls. The tail rotor ceased to function, sending the helicopter spinning wildly on its axis. Thick black smoke filled the air around them, certain evidence that there was a fire somewhere in the aft section of the aircraft. The pilot's hands and feet were in constant motion as he sought to overcome the rotation and land without smashing the aircraft and all its passengers into a million pieces.
Blackbird lead is going down! I think it's going down! Hold on!
Cade came to only a few moments later, still strapped into his chair. Next to him, the pilot was being hauled out of the wreckage by several other knights. Groggy, but able to move under his own power, Cade managed to follow suit. Other knights were helping the rest of the team out of the rear of the aircraft. As soon as he was clear, Cade turned his gaze skyward. The thunderclouds were still there, twisting and turning about themselves. The pilot was good. Cade had to give him that. He'd managed to get them all down on the ground in one piece. Short of a few cuts and bruises and a broken leg for the hero of the hour, it looked like they would be all right. The Black Hawk was a different story. Its tail was broken off, its landing gear crushed, and its main rotors shattered into hundreds of pieces from the impact with the ground. As he walked away from the wreckage to the waiting HMMV that would take them to the trailer serving as a makeshift medical center, Cade had to wonder just what he had seen in the clouds overhead, and what was waiting for them in the tunnels beneath the base. After letting the medics give him a quick once-over and being assured that nothing was unduly sprained or broken, Cade left the med trailer and made his way over to the 45-foot mobile command center that Mason and his crew were using as a base of operations. While he hadn't been inside this particular model before, he was certainly familiar with such vehicles. He'd used them often during his days on the Boston Special Tactics and Operations team, and even a handful of times since joining the Order. While he personally preferred working out of the open tailgate of his team's SUV, he could understand the need for them on a prolonged op like this. This particular model was built on a Freightliner chassis and came equipped with a 450-horsepower diesel engine. It had workstations for 8 and seating for 11. In a pinch, the conference room could hold 15, though quarters would be tight. Interior electronics were powered by a 20-kilowatt generator and included satellite TV receivers, video surveillance cameras mounted externally on a 30-foot telescoping mast, UHF and VHF radios, mobile data computers, and other related communications and surveillance equipment, all of which were secured against intrusion. The center was also equipped with a 12-foot glide room, which was currently extended. Two of Mason's men were monitoring video feeds on the workstations set up inside the room, and Kate was tempted to ask them what they had seen during the helicopter incident. But the knowledge that the storm hadn't shown up on radar, and therefore probably wouldn't show up on video, kept him from doing so. Kate moved to the rear of the vehicle, where the conference table had been folded up and put away, creating an open space large enough to hold Mason's senior officers and the men from Echo's two squads. Each squad consisted of four men, every one of whom had been cross-trained in a number of different specialties. First squad, led by Sergeant Manny Ortega, included Corporal Phil Davis, Private Marco Chen, and Private Joe Calavecchio. Cade's own squad, the command unit, included Master Sergeant Riley, Sergeant Olson, and Sergeant Duncan. They were the best of the best, and if anyone could handle the problem in front of them, Cade was confident they were the right team to do so. Before leaving the commandery, each of the men had received detailed briefing folders that described the mission parameters, objectives, and logistics. The men were professionals, and so Cade didn't intend to spend too much time going over those details unless there were specific questions. He had one goal for this briefing, and one goal only: to be certain each and every one of them understood the sheer ferocity and power of what they were about to face. It was time to go to work.
All right, listen up. By now, you've all had a chance to study the mission parameters and the rules of engagement. I've no doubt that you will perform in your usual exemplary manner. I want to take a moment, however, to give you an idea of what we're up against.
Behind him, the plasma screen came to life.
What you are about to see are the last few minutes of footage that was recovered from Corporal Jackson's helmet cam after the failed incursion into the lower levels of the base. I think you will find it worth your time.
The video was full of interference, both from whatever was disrupting communications inside the perimeter of the base and from the poor lighting conditions in the room itself. The camera was close to the floor, shooting upward, and it was clear from its erratic motion that Jackson had been injured by this time and was probably rolling around in agony. He couldn't have been aware the camera was still recording, for there was no conscious effort to point the lens at the action unfolding around him, and it didn't stay in one position for more than a few seconds at a time. None of that really mattered, however, for Cade was only interested in a single segment, and when he got to it, he froze the screen. The camera had caught one of Jackson's squad members standing on the other side of the room, firing at something off-screen.
Watch closely.
As the men watched, something brushed onto camera from the left side of the screen, enveloped the knight in a shadowy embrace, and disappeared again almost as fast as it had appeared. Except this time it didn't go alone. It took the soldier with it. Cade let them watch it once through, and then took them through it a second time on a frame-by-frame basis. It didn't do much good. They didn't get any further details at that speed than the former. It was as if the shadow was only that, a shadow. And it had no physical substance for the camera to lock onto. Yet that couldn't be right, for it took more than a shadow to carry off a 200-pound soldier in full combat gear, particularly while being pumped full of lead from the machine pistol the soldier was carrying. By the time Cade stopped the footage, silence had descended on the room.
We've been through it backwards and forwards, three different ways from Sunday. And I have to be honest with you, we don't have a clue what it is. We've got several people doing an extensive search of the Order's physical archives, looking for clues. But the online database held nothing that could help us, and I'm not holding my breath waiting for a miracle. We'll be going into unexplored territory and facing an unknown foe. Communications will probably be erratic, and we won't be able to call for reinforcements if things go to hell. But if it was going to be a cakewalk, they wouldn't need us in the first place.
Kate turned to face Olson.
How long will it take you to get Nomad ready?
Half an hour to prep the main systems, another 45 minutes to fit the weapons platforms. Call it an hour and a half to be safe, maybe less if things go smoothly.
All right, good enough. We'll use Nomad to do an initial search of the location, and then, if it seems clear, we'll go in ourselves. The command squad will lead, with the first squad in close support. Any questions?
There weren't any, and so the team was dismissed to begin their preparations. Duncan had heard of the Order's unmanned vehicle systems, but had never worked with one personally, and so he asked to tag along with Olson during the system prep. The other sergeant was only too glad to have a second pair of hands for the tasks ahead, The Near Autonomous Observation and Mobile Armament Delivery System, or NOMAD for short, was one of the best operational robotic systems to hit the major military markets during the last 3 years, and the Order had managed to acquire several of them for its own purposes. Built on a rectangular base, it was small enough to maneuver through confined spaces of less than a meter in width and could make a neutral turn in just under a meter and a half. Its reinforced treads allowed it to manage trenches, curbs, or stairs with equal efficiency, and its meter-high rotating turret provided the perfect platform for both two-way audio and multiple optical systems. The vehicle's top speed was just over 5 kilometers per hour. Duncan and Olson spent the better part of an hour prepping and testing the main control systems, assuring that all of the basic movement commands could be carried out without difficulty. NOMAD could be controlled through a cable, fiber optic, or radio system, with a complete range of up to 1,000 meters, providing plenty of distance to assure the safety of the operator. For today's mission, they were going to be using the fiber optic system, as Mason had mentioned the interruption of the radio communications from the first team, and they did not want a repeat of that situation. Once they had tested the motion systems, they moved on to the vehicle's sensors, cycling the optics through visual, infrared, and ultraviolet spectrums. Everything checked out fine. NOMAD sported a fully articulated arm that could be extended up to 6 meters in length and rotated a complete 360 degrees. The arm ended in 2-pincher claws for grasping and lifting objects weighing up to 150 kilograms. 7 weapons mounts were also available, and it was to these that Olson next turned his attention. While Duncan continued practicing with the control systems, Olson radioed Cade and then spent several moments discussing the firepower options. They would be infiltrating a closed structure and had no real idea of what to expect by way of opposition. So they finally settled on a diverse payload that would cover as many options as possible, yet not cause extensive damage to the structure around it should the firepower prove to be necessary. After seeing that video, no one doubted that it would. The only question was whether it would have any effect at all. Captain Mason suggested that they wait until morning to make the incursion, but Cade was adamant that they act as soon as possible. He had little doubt that some of the captain's concerns stemmed from the fact that less than 10 hours ago, Cade was lying near comatose in a hospital bed. Had he been in Mason's place, he supposed he'd be a bit concerned as well. But the truth was, other than a bit of soreness, he felt fine. Better than he had in a long time, in fact. There was no reason to delay the investigation on his account, and more than one reason to move ahead quickly. They had no idea what kind of enemy they were facing, or what their enemy's ultimate objectives might be. For all they knew, tomorrow morning might bring a full-scale attack from the depths of the base, and that was a chance Cade was not willing to take. So as soon as he heard that NOMAD was operational, he ordered the team into place. It was time to do the job they had come here to do. The plan was to approach the base within the relative safety of a pair of HWMMVs. Their armored exterior and high mobility would provide significant protection should they come under attack during the initial entry, and would also provide a means of exit should that prove necessary. The command squad would be in the lead vehicle, with first squad bringing up the rear. Once inside the base, they would set up position roughly 100 feet from the entrance to the building, where Mason's men had come under attack. From there, they would deploy NOMAD, using the robot for the hard task of entry into the building. If things came back all clear, then and only then would Echo physically enter and investigate. The men loaded the trucks quickly and then climbed inside. Both crews had been ordered to have a man standing half in and half out of the upper hatch, so that they could keep an eye on the storm overhead while watching the shadows around them in the afternoon sunlight. Kate didn't want the team to be taken by surprise, buttoned up in their trucks like a bunch of turtles, and he took the observation position in the lead vehicle himself, knowing he'd feel better being able to eyeball things rather than having them relayed over the radio. He gave the order, and beneath him he felt the vehicle rumble into life. It was only a short distance to the entrance of the facility when the team reached it without mishap. The wide gate had been secured in the open position by the ill-fated squad that had come before them, and so Cade simply waved both vehicles through without stopping. The base had very few roads to begin with, and only the main one that ran through the center of the base like a dividing line hadn't been reclaimed by the shifting desert sands. Housing and recreational facilities were on the right-hand side of the street, administration and support buildings on the left. The buildings they passed were in bad shape. paint peeling from tired walls, roofs slowly decaying into the interiors, empty windows staring at them as they slowly drove past. Jackson's squad had been through them all front to back, and Kate knew there was nothing there to either interest or concern them at this point. No, their destination was the larger building about another 100 yards ahead on their left. From the audio and video footage they'd salvaged from the previous attempt, it was clear that the facility had once served as the base motor pool. Its interior was divided into several garage bays complete with power lifts, old barrels of oil, and shelves of parts on every wall, while the central common area could have held a good dozen half-ton trucks or similar vehicles. How Jackson's team had even found the hatch that had gotten them into so much trouble was uncertain. The record of their excursion was spotty at best. From what they could see, it appeared to be in the middle of one of the aforementioned bays, but that was yet to be confirmed. They'd be relying on Nomad to give them a better idea of what they were facing. Cade kept a constant watch on the twisting column of darkness that rose over the buildings to the south, about 400 yards away from them. While in the chopper, he'd been close enough to see that the column was stationary, but that didn't mean it would stay that way. He half expected it to suddenly start acting like the twister that it resembled and become mobile. Oddly, there was no sound accompanying it, and that made him more than a bit nervous. Something that big, something displacing that much air, should have growled with a life of its own the way a big tornado will. This one was silent, and if he needed any proof that it was unnatural, this did the job nicely. Riley took them to the designated location and then swung the HWMMV around so that it was facing back in the direction they had come. The position would make it easier for them to get out of there quickly should the need arise. The driver for first squad, Chen, did the same, though he kept his vehicle half a dozen yards behind Riley's, preventing the enemy from hitting them both with the same attack. Kay lowered himself back inside the vehicle and moved up to the front passenger seat. He pulled the microphone from the dash and contacted the command center.
Echo to TOC. We've reached the target and are starting phase two.
Roger that, Echo. Good luck.
The transmission was full of interference, as expected, and Cade knew they wouldn't have the option of using the broadband radio for much longer. Rather than wait until they'd lost touch with Mason, who was operating as Tactical Operations Command for this mission, he ordered his men to make the switch to the tight beam tactical communication system integrated into their helmets. This would allow them to stay in touch with each other, even if they lost contact with the TOC.
All right, men. Form up a perimeter in front of the motor pool.
Riley, Duncan, and Cade set up in defensive positions around the lead vehicle, being careful not to block Wilson's line of fire from his position in the turret of the second. Once they were ready, it was time for Olsen to go to work. After lowering a ramp from the rear compartment, he knelt in front of the command console and used the controls to power up the strange-looking contraption sitting in the cargo space of the HWMMV. Because of the interference they'd already been experiencing with the radios, he'd opted to use the fiber optic interface, and so he gave the leads one last look to be certain they weren't tangled. It wouldn't do to lose connectivity with the machine because he'd been lax in his checklist. Once he was satisfied, he drove the robot out of the cargo area and sent it on its way. The vehicle was controlled through three different LCD screens representing a forward, backward, and alternating side view from the vehicle's onboard cameras and a small joystick, much like a video game. The control box was just a bit too large to hold for any long period of time, a design flaw Olsen was still miffed about, and so he was obligated to kneel before the console to operate it comfortably. This prevented him from having a weapon in hand, but he trusted the others to watch his back, and he did have Nomad's firepower at his disposal if necessary. The huge rolling bay door that provided access to the interior had been jammed open during the previous incursion. Olsen took advantage of that fact, rolling Nomad up within a few feet of it, and then extending the robot's telescoping arm beneath the door. When he triggered the camera mounted on the end of the arm, he was able to see inside the building. Expecting to see the bodies of Jackson's squad still lying where they had fallen several days ago, Olsen was surprised to see that the floor ahead was clear. He swiveled the camera, checking out as much of the interior as possible. Sunlight poured in from the windows high on each wall, banishing much of the darkness in the center of the room, but creating deep shadows inside the various garage bays and preventing him from seeing what each might contain. Similarly, it was difficult to see what might be lying in wait on the catwalk high above, as the incoming light blinded the camera to some degree.
Commander, come here a sec.
Kate and Olson discussed the situation briefly. Neither man liked the idea of sending in the troops just yet. The fact that the bodies were missing disturbed both of them. It suggested that the shadow creatures possessed at least a rudimentary intelligence level, which made them more dangerous. For all they knew, the shadow creatures could be lying in wait in the various work bays, waiting for them, waiting for more unsuspecting prey to wander into their den. They decided to send Nomad inside the building to test the reaction of anything that might be waiting inside. If there was no response, Echo would then advance. Olsen guided Nomad forward under the garage door and into the building proper. He advanced the robot into the center of the room and then brought it to a halt. With all of its onboard cameras active, he slowly turned it through a 360-degree arc, giving him a good look on all sides. The facility appeared just as it had in the video footage they'd seen. A central common area surrounded by 8 bays for servicing vehicles, 4 on the left and 4 on the right. It was the last bay on the left that they were most interested in, for that was where Jackson's squad had located the mysterious hatch. They were going to have to check all of them out to be certain the facility was secure before venturing inside themselves, though heaven knew just what they were looking for. He switched Nomad's video cameras into infrared mode and did another slow 360-degree turn, checking for heat signatures that the visible light camera might have missed. Nothing unusual showed up on any of the screens. Olsen nudged one of the controls with his thumb, and the camera tilted upward until it was pointed at the ceiling. He repeated the same sequence of action, a visible light search followed by an infrared one, but again found nothing unusual.
Looks clear.
All right, let's check the bays. Start on the right and work your way over to those on the left.
Roger that.
Olsen directed Nomad into the first bay on the right, scooting it around the vehicular hoist in the center and taking care to check behind the oil drums stacked against the rear wall. He used the manipulator arm to open the doors of the tool cabinet and to check under a discarded tarp in the corner. Not finding anything of interest, Olsen drove Nomad back out of that bay and into the second, repeating the search in the same manner as the first. One by one, he declared each bay empty of any noticeable threat. Finally, he came to the last bay on the left. Olsen brought Nomad to a halt just outside the entrance to the bay and used the spotlight to examine the interior, just as he had with each of the others. The vehicular hoist seen elsewhere was missing here. Gone, too, were the barrels and tool cabinets. In their place was the floor-level trapdoor that Jackson's squad had uncovered during their ill-fated sweep. The hatch itself was still open, just as the squad had left it. Olsen took his hands off the controls for a moment and flexed his fingers, working out the tension that had built up during the last half hour of work.
Take us in closer. Let's get a good look inside that hatch.
Olsen did as he was instructed. From there, he raised the telescoping arm and extended it out over the floor until it was able to look down into the open hatch. They had a quick glimpse of a vertical shaft that disappeared into the darkness below, and then, without warning, Nomad's cameras went dark.
What happened?
Not sure yet.
Olsen checked the fiber optic leads, figuring one of them had gotten tangled and simply pulled free, but they were still securely attached to the control unit. When those checked out, he moved on to the camera controls themselves, just in case he'd accidentally turned something off that he shouldn't have, but that too turned out to be a bust. In fact, he could see that he was still receiving a signal from the camera. It just wasn't showing anything through the viewfinder. He explained as much to Cade.
Switch to infrared.
Olsen did so, but that too was inoperable. Concerned that they were going to lose the unit, he powered up the motor and backed the robot away from the hatch. The minute Nomad left the repair bay, the camera began transmitting a signal again, as if nothing had ever happened.
You want me to run it through a complete diagnostic? See if it's a software bug or something?
I think it's time we gave it a look for ourselves. Assemble on my position. Prepare for entry into the structure.
The command squad would go in first, with Ortega's first squad watching their backs. When they reached the repair bay, first squad would form up in a semicircle facing outward into the common area, while Kate and the others checked the hatch. It wasn't a perfect plan, but it would at least provide them with some measure of warning should the enemy show itself again, and they'd therefore be better prepared to deal with it than Jackson's squad had been. Kate looked at the men assembled around him, checking to be certain they were prepared for what lay ahead. He needn't have worried. They were all professionals, and more than ready to step off into the darkness to face the unknown. Riley must have guessed what was going through Cade's head, for he gave him a quick smile and racked the slide on his combat shotgun, signaling his readiness to get underway. Flicking the safety off his own weapon, Cade stepped toward the building, his men in position around him. Compared to what Jackson's squad had faced when entering the motor pool several days ago, Echo's entrance was practically anticlimactic. They cleared the room swiftly and professionally, confirming Olsen's earlier assessment through Nomad that the place was now deserted.
First squad, move into position.
Kate entered the last repair bay on the left, with Duncan, Olsen, and Riley on his heels. Using hand signals, Kate indicated that Riley and Olsen should circle around the open hatch so that they could approach it from either side. He caught Duncan's gaze and pointed upward, indicating the young sergeant should keep his eyes on the rafters above. That left him to take the most direct route, approaching the open hatch from directly ahead. Step by step, they closed the distance, each of them fully expecting something to come charging up out of the shaft at any moment. But nothing did. They were able to reach the hatch without incident, and as one, they shone their lights down into the darkness below. The shaft was roughly 3 feet square. A series of metal rungs bolted to one side formed a ladder that disappeared into the darkness below. There was no sign of the shadow thing that had attacked Jackson's squad, nor was there any sign of the missing bodies.
Give us some more light.
Riley withdrew a chemical stick from his belt, activated it with a quick snap of its casing, and then tossed it into the shaft. By its light, they could see that the ladder extended all the way to the bottom, some 30 feet below. The opening of a tunnel was also visible on the wall opposite the ladder. Far below, the base of the ladder itself was clear.
Seems there's more here than meets the eye.
All right, boys, time to earn our pay. Riley, you take point. Duncan, you're his backup. Ortega, I want you on rear guard. Nobody comes down this shaft after us without my knowing about it, clear?
The other man nodded.
Once Riley and Duncan give the all clear, the rest of us will follow them down and see where that tunnel goes. All right, let's do it.
The light stick's initial bright flare had passed, but there was still enough light in the stick to see the rungs without too much difficulty. Riley slung his weapon over his shoulder and started down the ladder, while the others covered him from above. When he had descended about 15 feet, Duncan started down after him. The descent passed without incident, and the two men soon found themselves standing at the base of the shaft. Their weapons were fitted with both a laser targeting light and an optional sight LED, standard issue equipment among the various Templar rapid response squads, and so with a flick of a switch, they used the ladder to illuminate the area ahead of them. Riley used the tactical radio to contact Cade.
We got a tunnel ahead of us running due south for about 10 yards before opening into a wider space. We're gonna check it out.
Roger that. We're on our way down.
The big master sergeant stepped forward with Duncan close at his heels. A few moments later, they emerged from the tunnel onto a wide platform like that found in a subway station. Another larger tunnel ran perpendicular to the one they had just emerged from, reinforcing the comparison. The platform itself extended only for another 10 feet before ending in a wall. When Duncan shone his light into the second tunnel, he discovered a set of thick steel rails running away into the darkness. Along the ceiling, running parallel to the rails below, were a set of electrical cables.
The heck do they need with a monorail?
The base above had just been a good set of camouflage. The real facility was down here, below ground and hidden from even the best spy satellites. When Kate and the rest of Echo caught up with the point men, the decision was made to continue forward down the tunnel. Riley and Duncan would advance slightly ahead of the rest of the party. They in turn would be strung out in a line, the standard 5 feet between each man, with Cade in the lead and Ortega bringing up the rear. They would stick to the middle of the tunnel, giving them as much room to maneuver as possible. Expecting the equivalent of a New York City subway tunnel, Riley was surprised at the condition of this one. It was cool but dry, the desert heat on the surface above keeping the moisture from accumulating down below, and there was very little debris anywhere along its length, nor were there any rodents. The darkness, however, was all-encompassing, and it seemed to crowd around him. The light he carried was a powerful one, but it had a narrow beam, and so it did little to banish the sense that he was slowly being smothered as the darkness flowed in like water to fill the space in the absence of the light when he turned to look at something new. It was unnerving. He could almost feel it crawling across his skin.
Oh, come on, get over it. You stopped being afraid of the dark when you were 2, remember?
But it wasn't just the darkness. That he knew. It was what that darkness could be hiding. The video of Jackson's unit and the being that they had faced had gotten under his skin in a way that few things had during his years with the Order. He'd fought against hundreds of different supernatural creatures over the years, from witches to were-creatures, from the living dead to the ghosts of people past. None of them had bothered him like this. There was a wrongness about the creature that struck him at his core, a gut sense deep inside that cried out against it, that shuddered in revulsion at the knowledge that such things walked the face of the earth. He wondered how he was going to handle it when they finally came face to face. It was not an encounter he was looking forward to by any stretch of the imagination. They found the train about half a mile down the tunnel. It loomed out of the darkness, a behemoth filling the narrow space ahead, a spotlight at the top of the car, the dead eye of a cyclops staring down at them. Riley held up his left arm, fist closed, signaling for the group to stop. The team crouched in place, waiting for him to check things out. He took his time, giving the situation some thought and considering the alternatives. The train filled the tunnel. There wasn't half a foot on either side to allow them to get past it. They had no idea where the tunnel led, so backtracking and trying to find another way in was out of the question.
Which means we're gonna have to go through it.
He didn't like that idea. Didn't like it at all. They'd be penned up inside, their mobility and tactical options greatly reduced should they encounter something dangerous. It was the perfect setup for a trap, and he didn't want to think what it would be like encountering those shadow creatures in such a dark and confined space. But what choice did they have? Short of calling it quits, there wasn't any other option. They'd have to go straight through it and hope for the best. From where he stood, he could see that the two wide windows that fronted the driver's compartment had been smashed. The window frames were big enough to allow Duncan and he to enter through them without too much difficulty. Once inside, they could make their way down the length of the train and hope that they could find a way out in the rear car. Then, and only then, would he call the rest of the team forward. It wasn't a great plan, but it was good enough. He turned slightly so that he could see the others behind him, and then used hand signals to indicate his decision. Cade nodded his agreement, and as Riley cautiously began moving closer to the train, Duncan stepped up beside him. They crept forward and took position on either side of the sloping front of the engine car. On a signal from Riley, both of them stood and shone their lights inside the car. It was empty. The door at the back of the engine compartment was also closed, something Riley was pleased to see. The door would give them a few seconds of warning should something react violently to their presence. While Duncan covered him, Riley reached up and used the butt of his weapon to clean out any lingering pieces of glass from the window frame. Then, slinging his weapon over his shoulder, he boosted himself up and through the window into the train car. The compartment was small, containing just enough room for a set of manual controls and a small bench seat for the engineer to sit on. Safety glass littered the floor. The good news was that the car was as empty as it had appeared to be from the tracks below. Better yet, nothing came charging through the door after him. He signaled to Duncan and covered the door while the other sergeant climbed into the car. Duncan slid up next to the door, taking care to keep his head below the level of the window so that he wouldn't be framed in it as a target, and put his hand on the handle. Riley centered his weapon on the door and nodded to Duncan. The other man pulled the door open, and Riley shone his light down the center of the other car. It was a standard tram car, with bench seats lining the walls and several floor-to-ceiling poles placed throughout the space. There was a door at the far end of the car, leading to the next one in the chain. Duncan slipped through the door, quickly cycling from left to right, assuring that no one was hiding against the wall on either side of the door. Satisfied that the car was empty, they moved to the far end and repeated the procedure, this time switching positions. Finding that car empty, they moved through it toward the next. Halfway across the car, they encountered their first problem. Riley's light faded and then winked out.
This is no time for jokes.
I'm not joking.
Riley gently smacked the side of the light a few times with his palm, but it didn't do any good. The light stayed dark.
Looks like I've got some kind of mechanical failure. You'd best take point.
Duncan's light was working fine, and so they continued moving forward until they reached the door to the next car. Riley stepped up and placed himself to one side, his hand on the door handle, being careful to avoid crossing directly in front of the window, just as Duncan had done three times before this. Duncan stood in front of but a few feet back from the door, the muzzle of his HK MP5 pointed at the center of the door.
Ready?
Duncan nodded. The other man pulled the door open. At the same moment, the light on the end of Duncan's weapon winked out, and the two men were plunged into total darkness.
Shit!
the tightness of the car itself, the constant tension from not knowing what was around the next corner, the unusual nature of the enemy that they were hunting, all of it combined to make both men feel off their usual game. And the darkness did nothing to help the situation. But the darkness didn't hold sway for long. Before either man could do anything more to react, they were faced with a new problem. In the car ahead of them, a thick greenish glow began to pulse from somewhere in the back, illuminating the figures that were moving toward them down the center aisle.
Contact!
Ceasefire! Ceasefire!
In front of them, the enemy was lost in the darkness, the mysterious strobe light suddenly winking out with the arrival of the rest of the team. Kate pushed between Duncan and Riley, staring ahead at the strange tableau, lit now by only the thin beam at the end of his weapon.
Lights! We need some light up here!
Flashlights were handed forward. In their high-powered beams, the identity of their assailants became immediately obvious. It was D-Squad, 3rd Platoon, Jackson's missing teammates. Kate stepped forward, moving amongst the bodies. Closer examination showed that they had been tied upright to the posts that served as handholds throughout the train car, their arms extended and secure to the horizontal crossbar. They'd been tied so tightly that not even the onslaught of Echo's bullets had torn them loose. With a strobe light flashing behind them, their positioning had given the illusion that the bodies were lurching forward. It was an eerie spectacle, shocking in its blatant use of the dead. Just what did their opponent hope to achieve with such a display? What was the value of dragging the bodies down here into the dark and arranging them like life-size puppets that no one would ever see? Unless, of course, it had known that they were coming.
Freaking weird sense of humor.
Ortega's comment struck Kay between the eyes. Could that be it? Could this have all been some kind of a sick joke? An attempt to get under their skin and play with their emotions? There were 9 bodies in all, which meant that the entire platoon was now accounted for, if you included Jackson. Cade shone his light on the various corpses, searching for one in particular. When he found him, he pulled his knife and carefully cut the ropes holding him in place. By the time he had the man free, Duncan and Riley were there beside him, helping him lower the body gently to the floor. The name tag on the front of the man's uniform read, Stoddard. From his review of 3rd Platoon's personnel files, Cade knew that this was the lieutenant that had been in charge of the patrol. He'd been young, 28 or 29 if memory served, but you wouldn't know it by looking at him now. His face was shrunken, collapsed in on itself, the once smooth skin now gray and wrinkled. His eyes bulged from their sockets, and his mouth remained frozen in an O of surprise or fear. Cade wasn't sure which. Even stranger was the fact that the man's hair, once jet black, had now gone completely white. A quick glance at the rest of the body showed that they, too, were in a similar condition.
What do you think, boss? Could it be a white? Or maybe a nest of Shang-Chi?
There hasn't been a white sighting in the continental U.S. for more than 50 years. Besides, this isn't the right environment for them. I'd be inclined to think it might be the Shang-Chi.
Cade referred to the vampire-like creatures of Chinese origin.
Except for the fact that the eyes are intact, and they're always one of the first things to go.
Which leaves us back at square one.
Turning his attention back to Stoddard, Cade searched the man for injuries. There were a variety of bullet wounds, but from the lack of blood, it was clear that all of them were post-mortem. Duncan and Riley's handiwork, no doubt. But aside from these, that was it. There were no other obvious injuries that could have caused the man's death, aside from the strange condition of his face. It was as if the very life force had been sucked out of him. What could do that to a man? They'd already eliminated the known candidates. Could it be a new species? Something they'd never encountered before? He was tempted to take off his gloves to try and use his sight, that psychometric power given to him during his encounter with the adversary several years ago, but knew it would be pointless. The bodies had been down here for over 48 hours. Any residual information the corpse might have held was now long since out of reach. Movement to his left caught Kate's attention. Duncan had drawn his combat knife and was moving toward the rest of the bodies, seemingly intent on cutting them down as well. Kate stood quickly and grabbed his arm, stopping him.
We don't have time. We've got to keep moving.
But we can't leave them here like this.
Kate gently turned the other man around so that he was facing away from the corpses, forcing him to pay attention to what was being said.
We have to. I don't have the manpower to watch over the bodies, and we can't spare the time to take them back through the tunnel to the surface.
But...
it's only temporary, Duncan, I promise you. We've got to focus on the mission, to complete what we came here to do. But we'll be back to give these guys the proper respect and care they deserve. You have my word.
Reluctantly, Duncan nodded. He knew the commander was right. They didn't have any other choice, but that didn't mean he had to like it.
Collect their signet rings.
Cade returned them over to Captain Mason as evidence of their fate, just in case something happened to the bodies before they could return. Once that had been accomplished, the team continued through four more cars without incident before coming to the end of the train and exiting out through the service door in the rear. The tunnel stretched on before them in the darkness, and they continued on their way, this time with Olsen and Cade on point.